Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, and we are going to begin by talking with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, easily one of the most brilliant and insightful men I've ever known and met, and he joins us to share his wisdom about church news and current events. We've got quite a lot of happy news, but I want to begin with a small bit of bittersweet news, and that has to do with the passing of our mutual friend, Dr. Paul Thigpen. I mean, this man was a giant in the Catholic world. Editor, author, contributor, thinker. He was astoundingly intelligent, convert to the Catholic faith. Having gone through his own journey, it was a weird and twisted journey, into eventually Protestantism and then Catholicism, and then devoting the rest of his life to the focus of applying his degrees in historical theology, the history of theology, to the service of the church, especially as an editor and contributor and author. And his death came as a shock to Matthew and me, and we're still rather reeling from it. But do pray for his soul, and that's the bittersweet part. He was such a holy man in life that I hope in the mercy and love of God that he is on his way to the beatific vision. But pray for him. Pray for him nonetheless. We're going to devote an entire segment to him about a day or so from now. We go on from speaking with Matthew to talk with Mary Kate Zander. Last month, a young woman named Fox Varian won a medical malpractice lawsuit against doctors who convinced her to get a mastectomy so that she could live as a boy. The case is touted as a landmark victory, and we heard similar cheers ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned, but we have not seen a cogent plan for next steps when it comes to the abortion problem. So what we ought to be doing as the pro-life coalition and movement is to learn from what's happening in the fall of the transgender movement right now and to really take the momentum, the legal momentum, into fighting for legislation so that the right of life of children in the womb will be fought for and preserved. And finally, we speak with Patrick Riley, founder of the Cardinal Newman Society. Pro-abortion professor Susan Osterman of Notre Dame University has rejected position in the Asian Studies Department. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, February 26th. It's the feast of St. Victor the Hermit. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Catholic author and convert Paul Thigpen has died. Thigpen was the author of several books, including The Manual for Spiritual Warfare and The Saints Who Saw Hell. He also wrote a book exploring the Church's teachings on extraterrestrial life. He was a regular guest on Ave Maria Radio and other EWTN programming and was scheduled to be interviewed by EWTN News the day before he died. Thigpen died yesterday at the age of 71. Another round of nuclear talks are being held by the U.S. and Iran in Geneva. This comes as President Trump continues to warn Iran about possible military action if a deal isn't reached. The president gave Iran a deadline last week of 10 to 15 days to make a deal. There will no longer be daily updates from police about their search for Nancy Guthrie in southern Arizona. The Pima County Sheriff's Department says daily updates on the 84-year-old's disappearance will now be limited to new information that warrants release. Guthrie, the mother of Today's Show co-host Savannah Guthrie, has been missing since February 1st, but few developments have surfaced over the past week. And if you're looking for a better quality sleep, all you may need is a pet. Bree Tennis with more.
Psychologists say allowing your pet to share your bed will enhance feelings of security, comfort, and reduces anxiety and loneliness. A Mayo Clinic study says co-sleeping with your pet improves your quality of sleep by about 83%. But that co-sleeping does have a downside. Some pets hog the pillow, the blanket, and snore. And the Cleveland Clinic says all that fur and pet dander needs to hit the washer at least once a week, but it's probably worth it.
And with your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm joined by my dear friend, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we talk about church news and current events. Matthew, thank you very much for being so generous with your time once again. How are you?
Oh, privileged to be with you, as always. A blessed Lent to everyone.
Yes, blessed Lent to you and your bride and everyone at EWTN as well. And I think it's important that we begin by addressing some stories of mutual interest, chief among which is the passing of a mutual friend, Paul Thigpen. Gosh, out of left field.
It came as a real shock to me and to a lot of other people. So for those who may not be familiar with him, he was a genuinely brilliant theologian, writer. He explored the idea of extraterrestrial life, but he did so from a deeply Catholic position. He was a convert, and for so many, as you said, he was a friend. I had the immense privilege of succeeding Paul back in the day as editor of the Catholic Answer magazine. Mm. And that transition was made so smooth, and I recognized very quickly that it was very difficult to succeed somebody with the breadth of his knowledge, and also, to be honest, just his goodness and his kindness, and he was a real Southern gentleman.
You know, that has always been my impression of him as well, and everyone whom I know who knew him personally attests that for as prolific a giant as he was, he had a really tender, fatherly, prayerful heart.
Yeah, he did. And there was it's that word gentle. I don't think I've really encountered that many people who were engaged in media as he was, who was also such, I'll use that word again, gentleman in how he approached things and how he dealt with people. Part of it, I think, was growing up in Savannah, Georgia. I think part of it was his family, but I think so much of it, too, was just by temperament. He was deeply kind, and it showed itself in all of his dealings and in his writings. And he was so nice that it was also easy to forget just how superbly educated he was. I mean, this is somebody who had degrees from Yale University and both a master's and a doctorate in historical theology from Emory University. So, I mean, he was beautifully trained. And then, of course, went on to become this Protestant pastor and then converting to Catholicism. But along the way, his conversion experience, and I'll leave this to others to detail more fully, but his dabbling with the occult, his time as an atheist, really, that famous phrase that he used, that he said, "I came to believe in the devil before I came to believe in God." Mm-hmm. And in that sense, he said that experience sent him, or me, he said, running back into the arms of our Lord. And it prompted him to write that remarkable book, Manual for Spiritual Warfare.
Yeah. If you don't mind us switching gears very quickly,
sure,
to another piece that we need to touch on very briefly, and that has to do with the situation in Notre Dame and Notre Dame University and the withdrawal of candidacy from an otherwise contentious subject. So, yeah, tell us about it. I'm trying to be very careful with my wording.
Very kind, here. Yes, exactly. We're talking about Paul Thigpen, who was deeply kind. in this case, this, I think, was really good news. Mm-hmm. That Professor Susan Osterman, who had been appointed to a very high-ranking position in a leadership in an institute for Asian Studies at it's the new Institute for Asian Studies at Notre Dame, has decided to decline the opportunity to become the head of this institute. She has done so in the face of what I think took a lot of people by surprise, probably at Notre Dame, just the sheer pushback, the outrage that accompanied her appointment, because she was so ardently engaged in the support of abortion. And I think over these last weeks, you and I have talked a little bit about it. There have been protests on campus. The students themselves have been up in arms, and we have seen a wide array of bishops, everyone from Archbishop Paul Coakley, who's the president of the USCCB, to now retired Denver, soon to be retired Archbishop Samuel Aquila in Denver, to Bishop Robert Barron, and also to the bishop in whose diocese Notre Dame falls, and that is the Diocese of Fort Wayne South Bend, and that's Bishop Kevin Rhodes. All of them have weighed in that this is simply not an appropriate appointment for a university that is supposed to be identifying with the Catholic faith. And I think this is very good news, but it's also a reminder that faithful Catholics don't have to just stand there and express outrage and do nothing else when appointments like this take place. That, in fact, if we organize, if we talk to each other, and we encourage the bishops especially to speak out, this is the sort of result that we can find.
And I'm really, truly glad for this happy news. We'll be talking more about that on this program. If you don't mind, Matthew, again, switching gears, let's talk about what we know about the Spanish bishops speaking out after their meeting with Leo XIV. The information was leaked.
Yeah, that we have very often, well, the Holy Father, let's put it this way, meets on a very regular basis with representatives of different bishops' conferences. You'll have whole bodies of bishops will be meeting with him in things that are called the ad limina meetings that I expect will be resuming. And those conversations very often are not supposed to be made public, that what the Holy Father has to say to different bishops is and should be privileged between himself and them. So I think the members of the executive committee of the Spanish Bishops' Conference issued an official statement, which is unusual, regarding the leaks about the meeting it had with Pope Leo XIV. Now, the article in question was published by El País, which is the Spanish, it's pretty far left, if I recall, as a publication in Spain. So it's not a big surprise that it would glom onto, or as they like to say, pounce on a leak that purports to say that the Pope warned the bishops that his greatest concern in Spain is the far right that is trying, quote, to instrumentalize the church. Now, obviously, once that was published, you had a lot of other outlets in Spain hitting on that very idea, replicating similar headlines, and saying that, trying to confirm various things that took place. The problem is that, again, there should be this respect for these meetings. And it's one of the reasons why I think this executive committee issued a statement basically saying that the Holy Father had received them with affection. He had listened to the presentation and encouraged them in evangelizing. Mm-hmm. And obviously that, as is one of the great themes of his pontificate, he had encouraged the bishops to, as the Holy Fathers want to say, to foster communion among the members and institutions that make up the church. So the Holy Father obviously in that sort of a dialogue is going to be talking about a variety of different things. And he talked about the risks of subjecting the faith to ideologies, but they said without mentioning any specific group. And the idea of those ideologies actually ties very closely into the Lenten reflections that the members of the Curia have been hearing from Bishop Eric Barden of Norway, who was picked by Pope Leo to provide those reflections. So the idea of instrumentalizing the gospel, that's nothing new. And there's a lot of question about whether Pope Leo is actually referring to the far right or any other specific group, as the Spanish bishops have said, that he did not mention any specific group. So we have to be very careful, I think, with what we hear sometimes in the press, as you know. And I think that's one of the reasons why they issued this statement.
And I have to say, it's not only disappointing, it really is a little irresponsible, but as is typical of a lot of press outlets in terms of pouncing on news, as you rightly mentioned, I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we are talking about current events in light of church teaching. We just concluded talking about the Spanish bishops and the statements they made after their meeting about with Pope Leo XIV was leaked. The information was leaked and published by the newspaper El País. Continuing on the other side of the break, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. Matthew, I want to ask for you to comment on this new piece of news about Pope Leo responding to an atheist who loves God, let alone the fact that that concept is baffling, to say the least. But Pope Leo took the time to respond to that question.
Yeah, we've had popes in the past who have commented or fielded questions. I think very famously, Pope Francis at one point was asked by a child about his father who was an atheist and whether he would go to heaven, that sort of thing. So there's nothing particularly new here. And it's very helpful, I think, in so many ways for popes and bishops and others who are qualified. We have to stress qualified. To discuss church teachings and the reality of atheism, in part because, as we have seen for some time now, this idea of the new atheism, that atheism is chic, it's cool, that the idea of moving past religions. So any conversation, I think, that hits on answering questions that people have is a good thing. So that's sort of a little bit of backdrop to the question that he was asked, and that is in there's a magazine called Piazza San Pietro, and in the February issue of the magazine, the Holy Father responded to a man from Reggio Calabria in Italy. His name was Rocco, and the question he had was, how is it possible to consider oneself an atheist and love God? I feel the need to love God, but I consider myself an atheist, or perhaps I think I am, and deep down, am I seeking God? So there's, right from the start, I'd be interested in your thoughts too on this. There is a seeking dimension to this. There is an openness in this question. And I think I appreciate what he's trying to get to. And then he added, he sent to the Pope a poem saying that I observe nature spying on every development, the sunrise or its setting on the horizon, the starry sky and the mystery of harmony. I believe that I don't believe, absolutely certain of nothingness, yet I still yearn for God. My drama is God, my restlessness is God, an atheist who loves God. Now, my blush reaction is, well, based on your poem and your question, I don't think you're an atheist.
That was my reaction too.
But let's accept it on the terms that, he's asking. And so Pope Leo's response was that he thanked him for the poetry. And then, as we would expect from Pope Leo, he quotes Augustine from the Confessions. And he talks about, you know, that late have I loved you. And then there's this line, you were within me and I was outside and there I sought you. And as Pope Leo says, it's enough to tell you that one cannot be an atheist who loves God, who seeks him with a sincere heart. And then he talks about different theologians who've reflected on what is important in life and seeking God. Yes, because as he says, the real problem of faith isn't believing or not believing, but seeking or not seeking him. And it is that quest. And I think Leo's really hitting on something very important, that so many young people today, especially, they're seeking God, but they don't necessarily have the language. They don't have the vocabulary, but it's there innately in them because it's written in us. And God is searching for us. God wants us. He loves us and he is calling us. But so many young people, especially today, I don't think are equipped to understand enough of what it means to seek, but they're still seeking anyway. And that's, I think, very important for the Pope to be stressing.
I agree. And like you mentioned, the intellectual disconnect with this statement I found particularly jarring because, like you said, the lacking of the vocabulary is indicative of the lacking of the intellectual categories to be able to think of these questions rightly. So someone identifies as an atheist, but if they don't think it through and don't have the right categories, really what he's saying is, I would rather not choose to ascribe to a belief in God, and yet I recognize an innate need to worship God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there is, whether he consciously admits it or not, it is a tacit, very real recognition that God exists. You don't love nothing.
Mm.
Now, you know, obviously there's a whole thing about the absence of what is the absence of love and all of that, and what is evil. But at the same time, I think Pope Leo has this great phrase that God allows himself to be found by the heart that seeks him. And perhaps, as he says, the distinction, again, is not so much between believers and non-believers, but between those who seek God and those who don't. And he adds that one can believe that one believes and not seek the face of God, not love him. One can believe that one does not believe and be ardent seekers of his face, loving him as you do. And he says, so, Rocco, we are all longing for love. We are all seekers of God. And therein lies the dignity and beauty of our lives. And I think that one of the other points, really key final points here, Deus Caritas Est, God is love. And we are, as created beings, seeking love. Again, whether we know it or not, whether we can articulate it or not, whether we have the vocabulary or not, we want to be loved. And if God is love, then we are seeking him and we are longing for him. And he is there. But we live in a culture today that makes it increasingly difficult to find the language for that. And I think Leo's cutting through all of that, as one would expect with St. Augustine.
And one would expect that with St. Augustine, truly, that our hearts are restless until they rest in mm-hmm. thee, and that, you know, you are more present to me than my innermost being. Let's talk about the African countries that Pope Leo XIV is doing an 11-day pastoral visit to.
Yeah, this is, I think, the most, he was just in Lebanon at the end of last year, so a very significant trip. This time, he is following very much in the footsteps of his predecessors. Pope Francis, I think, went to Africa 5 different times in a 12-year pontificate. And this one, though, is a major undertaking. So from April 13th to the 23rd, so we're really looking at, 11 days, basically. He's going to be visiting four different countries: Algeria, Cameroon, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea. The one that jumps out immediately, of course, is Algeria. Why? Because there is the direct tie in Algeria to the tradition, the legacy of Saint Augustine. He grew up in what would become many, many centuries later, Algeria. He is also very interested in the martyrs of Algeria. So that Augustine connection is there. But then as he moves elsewhere into Africa, we're seeing in a place like Angola that is on a pace to be one of the most populous countries in the whole of Africa. Mm-hmm. That's a place that matters increasingly in the reality and the future of Africa itself. And then with his visits to Cameroon, we're talking about another place where there are great pressures internationally, but then also where the church is really growing very rapidly. It's a similar reality in Equatorial Guinea. So the church is growing fastest in Africa than anywhere else on the face of the planet. And I think we're seeing Pope Leo in such an extensive trip, covering such an amount of ground, is sending that message to the African countries, to the African Catholics and the people of Africa, that they're not forgotten, that the Pope loves them. And let's also add one other really important point. More than almost any pope at the time of his election, Pope Leo has an intense amount of firsthand knowledge of Africa. Why? Because as Robert Prevost, he had visited there on a number of occasions. So he is very familiar with the reality of what is happening on the ground. He has visited East Africa at least half a dozen times as part of the Augustinians. He has a familiarity with the people there. And so that really matters, because I think as he's plotting out and what he's going to say, he's speaking from intense personal experience.
The final thing to also draw our attention to in terms of Pope Leo, it has to do with the fact that he's visiting Monaco. I've been talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. The time always flies when I speak with
him.
And we've been talking about church news and current events in light of church teaching. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
What is prayer? The Catholic Catechism defines prayer simply as the raising of our mind and heart to God. Humility is the foundation of prayer. When we pray, do we speak from the height of our mind and will, or from the depths of a humble and contrite heart? It is only when we acknowledge that we do not know how to pray as we ought, are we then ready to receive the gift of prayer. St. Augustine points out that when we come to the well seeking water, Christ comes to meet us. He first seeks us and asks for a drink. His asking arises from God's desire for us. God's thirst encounters our thirst. He thirsts that we may thirst for Him. Where does prayer come from? Scripture most frequently cites the heart. If the heart is far from God, the words of prayer are in vain. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Last month, a young woman named Fox Varian won a medical malpractice lawsuit against doctors who convinced her to get a mastectomy so that she could, quote-unquote, live as a boy. The case is being hailed now as a landmark victory for opponents of prepubescent sex change treatments. But I also want to advise some caution here. Those same cheers we heard when Roe v. Wade was overturned, for good reason. But we didn't have a cogent plan nationally for next steps. And in this situation, we really ought to if we want to move forward in the right direction. Joining me to talk about this is Mary Kate Zander, president of Illinois Right to Life. She's also the author of this piece in First Things called A Landmark Lawsuit, but let's not cheer too soon. Mary Kate, are you with us? Oh, well, as Mary Kate joins us, what I'd like to do is talk about the lawsuit proper. So, like I mentioned earlier, last month, a 22-year-old woman named Fox Varian, she won a lawsuit against the prior doctors because they coaxed her into getting, and parents, I just want to forewarn you of some of the terminology here. It was called top surgery. It's a double mastectomy. She was 16 at that point, and the doctors were pushing her so that she could, quote-unquote, live as a boy and therefore live in the way that she wanted to live. Because that was apparently the charitable thing to do, the compassionate thing to do, what have you. And this was pushed with very little assessment of her prolonged mental health and very little assessment of the prolonged effects that these procedures would have on her system. The surgery left her physically scarred, and psychologically she just registered as being deeply unhappy. It didn't solve her problems one bit. This law, so she sued her prior doctors, and she won. The lawsuit represents a major victory for opponents of precisely these kinds of interventions, prepubescent sex change treatments, especially parents, mind you, because very often the medical institutions here in the United States of America are pressuring parents into believing that if this isn't done, then effectively what is going to happen is that their children are going to do something to harm themselves and their lives. And so these narratives are pushed as if this is the charitable thing to do. This is the good parental thing to do. This is the compassionate thing to do. When really the driving force here has to do with novel medicine and most of all, money. This really is a follow-the-money situation. And so looking at Fox Varian's case, we see that this case is a landmark lawsuit. It really is the first time that any detransitioner in United States history has sued physicians for medical malpractice for precisely these prepubescent transgender medical interventions and was successful and won. So those of us who believe that protecting the dignity of the human person extends to treating gender dysphoria as a mental illness can now feel a little validated. Because we are cheering, to be sure, this landmark case is going to create what we call a legal precedent. But Festina Lente, make haste slowly. These cheers were the very same ones we made when Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. The cheers were loud, don't get me wrong, and rightly so. We had made a great stride in the federal courts. However, we might have cheered a little prematurely because we drowned out the voices of many people who are asking, prudentially no less, are we prepared for what comes next? Because what came next came immediately. So now states like Illinois, New York, California, they're contending with the pro-life movement's inability to answer that question, both in terms of the abortion debate at the state level and also, therefore, the transgender situation in medical interventions. So the lesson that needs to be learned here is we cannot make the same mistake twice. In the year 2024, Ohio and Missouri passed different versions of the ACLU's then supposed abortion-specific ballot referendum, but they weren't abortion-specific. The same amendment is now coming into play in Virginia. And sure, they're trying to introduce these in other states over the next few months, over the next few years. The purpose of this is to create an avenue where there's a particular kind of language. The language around things like reproductive freedom, the language around choice, the language around a mother's life and whatnot, all of these are being enshrined as constitutional rights to legalize at the federal level abortion. And these rights, they're being touted as rights, being touted as encompassing the infinite subjects. So you look at people like Mary Catherine Martin, an attorney with the Thomas More Society. She is concerned that this is potentially going to supersede even our freedoms of speech and religion. Because if codified, effectively, this is going to fall into the realm of the conversation of the right to life and the dignity of life. And that's going to create a kind of precedence over and above conversations of speech and primacy of religion, primacy of conscience. One of the key groups that's inevitably going to see impact by this and going to be heavily affected by this is parents, particularly of minor children. I want to make this clear. Ever since the advent of the entire transgender medical enterprise, minor children have been targeted, and they've been targeted outright. At the end of the day, it is state, legislature, and medical institutions that feel as if, that have been set up as if, they have the primary right of the good of these children who are minors. And so minor children who want to, quote-unquote, exercise their rights to reproductive freedom are being allowed constitutionally, especially if the laws are pushed forth, to go ahead with it. And in most of these cases, that's going to refer to a minor girl's decision to utilize things like birth control, even if she's procuring it from states that are not the state she resides in and they're mailed to her, or to abort her unborn child, especially by means of chemical abortion and the mifepristone fiasco that you and I are facing today that we continue to dialogue on this program. In many cases, however, that new right is going to be cited to this new right in air quotes, if I want to be clear here, is going to be cited to justify minor girls' double mastectomies and, unfortunately, even surgeries that completely mutilate reproductive organs without parental consent or knowledge. Make no mistake about this, my friends, that is the legal endgame here. What's startling, too, is I've covered over the past year or so on this program how Europe and most of the other nations across the world that led us, that were forerunners to us in terms of transgender medical intervention, whether by means of chemical hormonal intervention or surgical intervention, they've virtually all backpedaled their procedures. They have found that over the years of these enactments and for post-factum studies, they have found in double-blind peer review studies that these interventions, these surgeries, don't actually help the situation, that gender dysphoria still remains a mental condition, and therefore cognitive behavioral therapy and different kinds of psychological therapy ought to be the first level of intervention with the involvement of parents who alone desire the greatest good for children over and above the state and medical institutions and even well-meaning compassionate legislatures. So Illinois right now is laying the groundwork to introduce those amendments. Key legislatures are right now trying to speak about abortion and gender-affirming care as if they are in one breath, as if they should be stated in one breath, as if they're two sides of the same coin. J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, he has both a personal and family history when it comes to both abortion and same-sex treatments. And so Illinois is going to be one of those states that moves down this path. And not only has Pritzker implemented numerous laws and policies during his time as governor that are funding, by means of federal funding no less, funding, advancing, and protecting abortion and sex change treatments, he's got relatives that are some of the most high-profile individuals that are spokespersons for these things. And so the narrative now is being pushed in a further way to impact children, and willfully so. Sure, the program that's being launched by Illinois right now has treatments on hold because they are awaiting deliberation on things like executive orders, especially by the Trump administration. And yes, therefore, we can be grateful of some of the executive orders that are creating stays of execution for this issue. But Congress is not taking matters into their own hands. And so we are going to see that this fight is going to be at the level of the state unless we as a nation not only make abortion unthinkable, but make sex change treatments, medical interventions, surgical interventions for the entire transgender situation unthinkable. Until such a time, this fight has to continue, and let's be informed so that we can make our voices heard. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hello friends, Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here, and I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Living the Beatitudes with Father Bjorn.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The virtue of purity and holy chastity is certainly a very important thing, but I think we can misunderstand this beatitude. As human beings in our fallen state, we tend to love things and use people. But we're meant to use things and love people. We can manipulate in relationships, and we can try to control other people, and we can focus on other people as objects. But to be pure in heart is to be in love, and ultimately to be pure in heart and to be happy is to be in love with God Himself as well. This beatitude calls us to have a focus on being open to choosing God, choosing life, to choose love. If God is not the ultimate end of our desires and our hopes and dreams, we will be the saddest of people. Let's say yes to God and choose His way, be focused on His love and pure in heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
For more about the Beatitudes, visit EWTNRC.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. This is not news to many people listening right now. Pro-abortion professor Susan Osterman will not assume leadership of the Asia Studies Department at Notre Dame. This is following widespread, even global backlash from bishops and other Catholic leaders. Patrick Riley, founder of the Cardinal Newman Society, joins us. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me on and talking about this very important issue.
I'm very glad to have you on to talk about this. And like you said, this is a truly crucial issue for a university that not only carries Our Lady's name, but is the bearer of the title of America's great Catholic university, so to speak. So and I know I'm starting off on very general terms here, but I want to hear your thoughts when you found out that Susan Osterman was being considered and named for that role in the Asian Studies Department.
Yeah, to be honest with you, my initial reaction was no surprise at all. I mean, she's been teaching there since 2017. Notre Dame has no problem with hiring such faculty and maintaining them, and has made it very clear with a number of moves over the last several years and last couple decades that it's devotion to a strong Catholic identity and to its original mission has been severely watered down. And so, you know, this is not to pile on Notre Dame, but this is just based on Notre Dame's own public announcements in terms of its changing its, you know, its moral expectations for its faculty, changing its requirements for faculty to uphold the mission of the university, basically putting it in terms of its reputation as a research university rather than in terms of fidelity to Catholic teaching. And so, you know, the very foundation of a Catholic university is the understanding that what the Church teaches is true. And that's the very motivation and basis for Catholic education. And unfortunately, that's no longer the bedrock at Notre Dame.
What's also heartbreaking is that the scandal broke out only because she was being considered for a position of leadership. But like you said, she's been teaching there for some years now without any uproar, and yet the uproar should have been there from the get-go.
Yes. I mean, there was something of an uproar in 2022 when Father John Jenkins, at the time the president of the university, publicly opposed her pro-abortion views. But basically did it in almost in the form of a dialogue or in terms sort of like a public scolding, and yet continued to maintain her on the faculty. I mean, and he really had no choice because, again, what the university has done over time is to adopt a very secular approach to understanding academic freedom and has abandoned the again, the fundamental understanding that what the Church teaches is true. And that is the bedrock foundation. I mean, that's the basement level of what defines Catholic education, is that it accepts the Church's teaching. And if it doesn't do that, and it doesn't expect its teaching faculty to do that, then you really have to question, you know, how long can it continue to identify as a Catholic institution?
The question really is whether or not its identification of a Catholic institution is honest, right? And for how long it can continue to tout that. Now, alongside that question, if I may so invite you to, what were some of the reasons that you founded the Cardinal Newman Society?
Yeah, well, it was experiencing very similar things in Jesuit education. My university, you know, this is going back now over 30 years ago, but was, you know, sponsoring pro-abortion activity with different student clubs, gay and lesbian advocacy that was clearly contrary to Catholic teaching, was actually had a counseling service that was referring students for abortions. And so all of this, as I was editor of the student newspaper and started writing about these things, and that's really what led me into it. Of course, it was also toward the very end of my time there that Pope St. John Paul II issued Ex Corde Ecclesiae, which in a much more eloquent and authoritative way stated basically the arguments that I was making, that, you know, explaining why I thought these things happening at this university were not consistent with its Catholic identity. And unfortunately, you know, much of higher education, much of Catholic higher education has followed in the same direction.
Ex Corde Ecclesiae was a real call for Catholic institutions to not only wake up, but to realize what it meant to call themselves Catholic institutions. Can you sum up some of the context of the Holy Father's words and the universities that have followed suit?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Ex Corde Ecclesiae really divided higher education among those institutions that embraced it. You know, many of those institutions are now recognized in the Newman Guide as faithful Catholic institutions, and then much of Catholic higher education rejected it. But if you look at the document itself, it's really, you know, pulls a lot of punches in a sense, in that it doesn't really require a whole lot that any Catholic university shouldn't be able to provide. But fundamentally, what it says is that a Catholic university understands, you know, just like any university is focused on the search and the teaching of truth, but being Catholic, it begins with an embrace of the truth that's given to us by revelation and through the church. And that's what distinguishes a Catholic university. And so in many ways, the Catholic university is more devoted to the truth than an institution that rejects the truth that God has given us. And it allows students and faculty to explore every discipline, every area of study in a deeper way, because we have the insights of our faith. We have the understanding of the Creator. We have the understanding of first principles that are basically rejected in a secular education. And so that was a general argument. In terms of what specifically it required, it required the mandatum for theologians, which is a formal credential essentially from the local bishop saying that somebody is qualified to teach Catholic theology. That was something that was in the Code of Canon Law since 1983, had never really been implemented, and Ex Corde Ecclesiae in 1990 said, you know, this must happen. And that was one of the big points of disagreement, where many Catholic institutions, in fact, the Association of Catholic Colleges and Universities here in the United States, publicly said that Ex Corde Ecclesiae was dead on arrival, that it was not going to be implemented here, and that they were not going to allow it to be implemented. And then it also requires that at least 50% of the faculty must be Catholic, so that there's at least a sizable portion of the faculty that's Catholic. Of course, we all know today that, you know, it all depends how you define Catholic. If Catholic simply means baptized Catholic, mm-hmm. you know, if 50% of the faculty are baptized Catholics, and today, what, you know, maybe 10% are actually, you know, seriously practicing, you know, you're talking about a very small number. So it's a very minimal requirement that really, at least in the United States, any institution should be able to meet. And yet, Notre Dame has been fighting was struggling. I haven't heard much about it in recent years, but was struggling to at least try to meet that 50% and was having a tough time doing it. And I don't know exactly where they're at right now, but since they're not talking about it, it makes me concerned that they may have actually dipped below that 50% Catholic faculty.
And I don't have the information on hand as well, but suffice to say this, the fact that there are departments within the institution that are decisively being led by and educated by people who don't hold the Catholic worldview, the institution at large is going to have a tough time declaring that they're faithfully Catholic. And so in the grander scheme then, as we're taking a look at institutions like Notre Dame, they've gone down a utilitarian education model. They've got some fame. They certainly have a large endowment. But the future of the human dignity of the human person really is these faithful Catholic education institutions, which are found in the Newman Guide.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're growing and they're doing well. We have lost over the last 10 years, 26 Catholic colleges have closed.
Wow.
I don't know. Yeah, about at the beginning of that, we were at about 210 total that cater to undergraduates, not including seminaries and such. So that's a very large percentage that have already closed, and it's only going to get worse. I mean, we're seeing this across private education. But, you know, you had in the 1970s, late 60s into the 70s, you had all these different religious orders opening small Catholic colleges, very regional, all over the country. And those institutions are closing. They can't compete with the state universities, and yet many of them are simply unwilling to embrace the strong, faithful Catholic identity that's needed to attract their base of support. And so they're just not making it. And of course, the orders are declining as well.
Well, I'm really, really glad to have had you not only join us, but to speak so candidly and boldly about this issue. Thank you very, very much, Patrick.
Thank you. God bless you.
I've been speaking with Patrick Riley, founder of the Cardinal Newman Society, and Patrick has been very honest. He's put his finger on the pulse of the problem, which is that one institution cannot call itself Catholic if it doesn't hold to the fullness of the Catholic ethos. So let's keep praying for Notre Dame. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.